Hard Rock Cafe is notorious for taking song lyrics and strategically placing them above doorway entrances to their establishments. For example, when you visit the Hard Rock Casino and Hotel in Las Vegas, you'll be greeted with the words, "When this house is rocking, don't bother knocking, come on in." A tribute to the great Stevie Ray Vaughan. We have a recommendation for the Hard Rock Cafe as well. This ain't no party. This ain't no disco. From the Talking Heads, Life During Wartime. Of course, this would be a cynical overtone to what's on the other side of those doors, which leads us into this Promotion Man podcast and Life on the Road with the Talking Heads.
So this podcast, are you introducing?
No, you're going to do it. Let me be quiet in my chair. So, okay.
Well, stop moving around. Jesus, squeaking, you're like, man, a little girl. So this series, this podcast series is called Promotion Man. It could have easily been called Promotion Rep. And the reason I say that is because today, this week we had a passing of one of our dear, dear friends, Tasha Mack.
Right.
Tasha had worked for Capitol Records for a long, long time out of the Dallas region.
Yeah.
And, you know, each promotion person was unique in their own right. And they were men and women, big and small, little and tall.
All walks of life.
And they were a community.
Yeah.
And you would, you know, when we would go to radio on Monday, we'd all sit in the lobby together and bullshit, trade each other's records, you know, give each other advances on whatever we had. And we were a community. And Tasha in particular was so sweet to me because Virgin Records had hired me and they wanted me out of the Dallas region. And my territory was Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana at the time. And Tasha knew that I was new, and she knew that I didn't really know a whole lot of people because in the record rep community, the Houston reps would call on Austin and San Antonio.
Right.
And the Dallas reps would call on Oklahoma and, you know, and that part of the, you know, Dallas and all of that. So not always did they intertwine, as you will. So Tasha and I ended up going to the Hyatt in Dallas, and there was the, they have a ball, like this globe, and it's a spinning restaurant.
Right.
Where it just moves around. And that night, there happened to be this crazy lightning show, and it wasn't raining. It was just this lightning show, and all the lightning was horizontal, and it wouldn't stop. It just kept on going, and her and I have these great expense accounts. We probably put your name down. And we drank like
crazy.
Sorry,
I missed it.
Yeah, but we put your name down there anyway.
All right.
And so we drank like crazy, and we had a blast, and we had so much fun we didn't want to like stop. And so we ended up cruising around. It was a summer night. We ended up cruising around Dallas, and all the bars were closed, and we didn't know what to do with ourselves, and we see this bingo hall.
Wow.
And she said, "Have you ever played bingo?" And I said, "No, never in my entire life." She goes, "Let's do it." So we go in there. And when you get in there, you have to buy your little supplies. You have to buy your bingo sheets. And then you get this little puncher.
Right.
This little ink stamp.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we only got two sheets each. And we're hammered. So we're laughing at each other. And we're making quite a bit of a noise. But the hall itself kind of freaked me out because I've never seen this type of people before.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, and I'll be as politically correct as possible, but there were some people that were missing limbs, they were missing teeth, they were missing eyes. Well, and it's probably 2 a.m, so who, you know, what kind of crowd's going to be hanging out in a bingo hall at 2 a.m?
That's right.
So it was a motley crew, to say the least.
Yeah.
And, we end up, they do the bingo thing, and she's so much fun. You know, Tasha, she was so much fun. I'm so going to miss her, but she was so excited because we won the very first game.
Oh, wow.
And we just went crazy. And the whole place was silent. Like, you could have heard a pin drop. It was silent.
Yeah.
And we realized right then and there that we had won $100, but we responded like we won the lottery. It was like $1 million.
Right.
We just went crazy. So we got our money and we slowly worked our way out the door.
Yeah.
And Tasha stops, turns around and goes, "Party on, motherfuckers." We got back in the car and we ended up going home.
The great thing about Tasha Mack, she, as Fred mentioned, she was well known. And no matter who you met, be it a record person or a radio person or just anyone, even out of the business, everyone had a completely different Tasha Mack story. I've got a quick story about Tasha myself. This one involves Dave Mustaine of Megadeth. And Tasha, when I first met her, you know, she was kind of, you know, like you said, she's got a potty mouth and she's a dude's chick, if you will. You know, she can hang with the boys, if you will, as I used to say. And she was like, Dave Mustaine had ordered a limousine to get him to the venue that night. So she was in charge of picking up the limo and picking him up there at his hotel. Supposedly, say if Dave Mustaine wanted a black limousine, she showed up in a white one. Now, he could have wanted a black one and she showed up a white one. I'm a little foggy on that part of it. But the funny thing about it is Dave refused to get into the limousine because he ordered a specific color.
Oh, you got to be kidding
me. He wanted this color limousine and Tasha got out and they're standing there on the sidewalk of this hotel
arguing about the color of the
limousine.
Oh my gosh.
She's like, look, Dave, I got to get your ass to the venue. He's like, I'm not getting in that limousine. And so finally she said, she looked at him squared in the eyes, I tell you what, I'm getting in this limousine and I'm going to the venue. The next limousine you want to get, it's going to be yellow. It's right across the street over there. It's a fucking taxi cab. So get in the limo or go get in that cab.
Good
so
for
she
her.
Said, you can take the yellow limo if you want to.
That was perfect, man. She was a dude's chick. She could hang with anybody.
She could, man.
We're going to miss you, Tasha.
Sure.
Back to our episode.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have any cleanup on aisle two this week, do we?
Out of six podcasts, this is the first one. There's no cleanup on aisle two. We got everything right last week.
No way. Well, look, little Ava was 15 like yesterday.
That's right. She just celebrated her birthday in July.
To you.
Yeah.
So at least put her in there.
All right. Here we go.
Okay.
There you go. It's little Ava, our cleanup on aisle two, who's now 15 years old. So happy birthday.
Good for her. All right. So we find ourselves in episode 7. And I feel like I need to clarify some things about me and Warner Brothers because there's times I've gone and I've reviewed these podcasts. And sometimes I sound like I run the joint and I don't.
Wait a minute. That's what you used to tell me when I first met you.
No.
You were the president of Warner Brothers.
No. In fact, it's worse than that. I was a local promotion man. And then, quite frankly, I was even a little bit lower than that because in Detroit, it was such a huge marketplace. And because of CKLW, they had a Detroit rep and then a Michigan secondary rep.
Wow.
So I was the Michigan secondary rep.
Okay.
So anytime through this podcast, when you thought I was all that, I really wasn't.
And the funny thing about it, any new promotion men or women who's listening to the podcast in the modern day era going like, wait a minute, you had two people for one city? It's like, I have to cover the entire half of the country now. You know, that's what we've morphed into.
Well, that's like when I was a virgin, I literally had Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas.
Wow.
That was my whole region until they broke it in half and put a Dallas rep and a Houston rep, which is what a lot of the big companies had.
Right.
So here's how the hierarchy worked in the record business. The company was set up from the top down where you had obviously the big cheese, which was Mo Austin.
Mm-hmm.
But then the promotion department had the president who was Russ Thyrette. And then you're going to have your vice presidents of rock and vice presidents of top 40 and each format, whether it's adult contemporary, country, R&B, jazz, and so on. Then you're going to have regionals and nationals. And the whole point is it's all about relationships.
Right.
That's what made this business work. So these nationals and regionals and vice presidents, they knew people in every single city in the country. So they were the support for the local promotion reps. So if the local promotion rep ran into a wall with a particular PD at a particular radio station, one of these people could usually call them and help out and help try to get the record on the radio.
It's like that scene in Pulp Fiction where Harvey Keitel comes in as the cleanup man. You know?
Yeah. Well, we had a lot of Harvey Keitels in our company. And then, quite frankly, the glue that held us together was this wonderful lady named Carol Hart, who I'll always have fond memories of. And I hope she listens to this podcast and gets a smile on her face because, you know, she was awesome.
Right.
And then, of course, you have the A&R people, which was originally called Artist and Repertoire,
right.
A&R, and their job is to actually go find the bands.
They're like a talent scout.
Yeah, they were the talent scout. That's exactly what they were. So they would find them, bring them into the fold, and champion their cause and hope to get them signed to the label. And then we had in-house producers and engineers. I think last week we talked about Ted Templeman and Don Landy. Well, those were the in-house producers and engineers. Then, of course, you have an advertising department and a publicity department and a marketing department and then sales.
Can I backtrack just a little bit on Ted Templeman?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to know this question. You know in the David Lee Roth video where he goes solo and he's got the Wheeler Dealer guy with the slick back hair? I've always wondered if that was actually Ted Templeman, because someone told me a long time ago that David had him in his videos. I was just kind of curious if you knew the answer to that, or maybe someone listening can let us know or not, because I've always heard that rumor.
I'm not sure, so I can't answer that, but I can tell you that David was quite an interesting character, and his partner in crime on his solo project was Pete Angelus, who started out as the Van Halen sound guy.
Gotcha.
So Pete's in a lot of those videos. Dave TV is what you're talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't surprise me if he conned Ted into a cameo, because that's how Dave was. He could con anybody into anything. So that wouldn't surprise
Very
me.
Very cool.
So I want to be clear that the promotion job that I had, I was as low on the totem pole as you could get. But I have to be honest, once I was in, I had my sights set on something better.
Right.
And I, you know, there was great things going on at the Bunny. So if you look at the bands that we've been talking about, they blend in together. It's a cohesive bunch. And that's a lot of record labels had that. So, you know, Fleetwood Mac, Doobie Brothers, Little Feat, Bonnie Raitt, ZZ Top, Robert Palmer, Neil Young. I mean, all of these really kind of blended together. And then I have to tell you, on this podcast, we've just been following my tour schedule.
Right.
So we haven't been following, like, releases of songs,
mm-hmm.
but I need to mention that in April, you know, 1 month after I started, we had signed this kid out of Minneapolis who wrote, arranged, produced, played all the instruments for his debut album called For You.
Yeah.
And that was Prince.
And that was released in April that year.
April 6th of 1978.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was 18. And, you know, and he had been working on the album quite a bit. But I did want to put that out there, because literally we had to find a path to follow on this Promotion Man podcast. And so we chose my tour schedule because it was crazy with bands. Which brings me to, all of a sudden we have these incredible bands. And then here comes Sire Records. Because Sire joined Warner Brothers Distribution in the fall of 1977, and we're now into 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So here comes the Ramones and the Dead Boys and Soft Cell and Modern English and Pretenders and Talking Heads. And then very soon after that, Warner Brothers signs the B-52s and Devo. So this is when New Wave was really born.
Yeah.
And as I was researching my Talking Heads information, you know, Psycho Killer, which was their first track that was released off of their debut album titled 77, mm-hmm. was under the genre New Wave.
Right.
You know.
And all those bands you mentioned all had huge hits. I mean, there was no stiffs there, you know. Every single one of them all had huge hits.
Well, and so here's the thing. We're following my tours, and all of a sudden, it's October 19th through 21st. I have the Talking Heads in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, driving over here, I was thinking, man, if I was to start this episode with a track,
right.
I was struggling with which one would I start out with, because Psycho Killer starts out so great.
It does.
Such a great song. But right now, well, the reason I'm on there on the road is they had just released the album More Songs About Buildings and Food.
Yeah.
Was recorded in the Bahamas with producer Brian Eno. And it was released with the lead single, Take Me to the River, the Al Green song. And it took off.
You know, we always talk about how great bands are. But, going all the way back to Elvis with, Sun Records and Sam Phillips, or the Beatles with George Martin. I mean, when you talk about a producer, it almost becomes that other member of the band, right?
No question. I mean, because now he took their sound and repositioned it. And created, you know, probably for the band, a template, you know, for them to use through their career. And that's why I think talented engineers and producers are an extended member of these musicians. But the other track that I was listening to right when I pulled in the parking lot here was Life During Wartime. And I got to tell you something. You listen to Tina and Chris, and they just hold down this incredible bottom.
Right.
That's really the driving force for the whole song. You know, the only way I could describe the Talking Heads was exciting.
The thing about the Talking Heads to me, and I never have met David Byrne, but I did meet Tina and Chris, and when they were in a little project later on just called The Heads, and it was, you know, the remaining members of the band, but they were so nice, so conversational, but it seems like during the era you're talking about is they were kind of in the background and David was always there in the forefront. But I guess your relationship, it was always about Chris and Tina, right?
Well, so we all started out kind of together, you know, and what I found about Chris and Tina and Jerry Harrison was they were just easy to be with.
Right.
And a lot of fun. So we're in Ann Arbor and it's a college town. It's the home of the University of Michigan. Go Blue.
You like that team, do you?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, so we goofed around. We went to WIQB, the radio station. We went to some of the local record stores and goofed around. And then we had the show that night. And then, you know, the next day we've got a show in Detroit. I never, ever really connected with David Byrne. And it was really only because he has a similar personality trait to maybe people like Prince and other people who are more introverted. And yet when they get on stage, they're extremely talented and much more extroverted in that spotlight.
And a lot of people that he's worked with, even, you know, in the modern era, like St. Vincent, for example, you know, seems to me like a female version of David Byrne. You know, she's very amazing on stage. But when you get her on a one-on-one, she's a little bit more quiet and eccentric. So I think that Warner Brothers knew where to find those particular type of artists.
Well, and that's why I would never say anything negative about someone like David, because it wasn't that he did anything wrong. He just wasn't somebody that warmed up to people really easily.
Everybody can't be David Lee Roth.
Well, and it's funny because the Detroit show was a huge show for them. We've talked about what a huge market Detroit was. And they had guests. They had Alice Cooper and Bernie Taupin, Elton John's writing partner. And they wanted to meet the band before they went on stage. And one of my pictures I've posted up on Promotion Man shows all of us together.
It's a great photo.
And you can actually see David Byrne kind of away from everybody, not really connected, you know, and it's just his personality.
Yeah.
The band was extremely exciting, and Take Me to the River was really the track that cracked the top 40 at number 26, and the album ended up getting as high as number 29 in the top 200. And the album went gold pretty quickly.
And that's respectable back then. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, you know? Very much so.
You had to sell a lot of records to break the top 30, especially.
Yeah, very much so. And for those of you that don't know this, I don't know if we've ever defined it, but a gold record is 500,000 units.
Right.
A platinum record is 1 million. Mm-hmm. And diamond is 10 million.
Right, right.
They don't give you an award for five. We're seven.
You got to hit 10.
You know, which also kind of reminds me about the band. So obviously they became, Talking Heads became a mainstay of rock throughout the 80s. And, you know, they had ginormous hits like Burning Down the House. We talked about Life During Wartime, Once in a Lifetime. You know, everything they started to release went gold and platinum. They were inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002. In the early, or I say the mid 80s, Tina and Chris had a side project called Tom Tom Club.
Yes.
And there's a lot of history about Wordy Rapping Hood being one of the first kind of rapping songs. Mm-hmm. And on that album was Genius of Love, which ended up getting sampled by Mariah Carey for an album she had called Daydream that went on to win an enormous amount of awards and actually sold over 8 million copies.
Wow.
So Tina and Chris did really well with that. And then their version of Under the Boardwalk was awesome. I love that.
You know, back to Fantasy, though. I mean, that little sample they used in there, I don't know who decided to use that sample, but it's such a great sample, and it's so catchy. And then when you add Mariah's voice on top of it, I mean, it's just what you call, like, honey. It's syrup, man. It's a hit. You know, the first time you hear it, you go, like, that song is a smash. And it's just because we were already familiar with the sample from the Tom Tom Club. Because we danced to that. Everyone had danced to that song in the clubs. And then all of a sudden, here we go, Mariah sampling it in the 90s. And boom, we got another huge hit again.
Yeah. And again, such an exciting platform, you know, musically. Because the Talking Heads were extremely exciting.
Sure.
And I was very lucky to have them in my territory often. because of all the college towns I had and and Detroit. And so I've had an opportunity to see a lot of shows.
So did they predominantly do kind of break from the college towns, or was it more just of a national spectrum and college just was probably one of their better audiences? Because you mentioned a radio station I wasn't familiar with earlier, WQID.
Yeah, it was WIQB in Ann Arbor.
So is that a campus radio station or is that a commercial radio station?
Actually, that was a commercial radio station.
Okay, okay. So but, I didn't know if you were just getting a lot of college radio airplay. Growing up and getting my career started in college radio in the early 80s, we were playing all of these bands. I mean, this was in heavy rotation for us. That's why I was just kind of curious if that particular new wave genre maybe developed from college radio.
I think it definitely did because, like I said, I inherited the 77 album.
Right.
And I remember calling on a college station in Kalamazoo, Michigan called Wider, WIDR, and she loved Psycho Killer, and it was in heavy rotation. And what was interesting about Take Me to the River was when that exploded, it kind of pulled some of their older material into the airwaves.
Right.
And just like listening to Psycho Killer today, it stands strong its own. It's exciting is the only way I can describe this band. And I think Tom Tom Club was a lot of fun, too. And then we should probably note that the evolution of Talking Heads brought in a lot of additional players that really filled their sound out. I mean, Bernie Worrell came in. He was with the Funkadelics. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just really pulled in a lot of people, which really kind of shored them up with a very full sound. And I think it was really exciting. And one thing I want to note, Tina was an incredible bass player. There's no question about it. But she's also a beautiful woman. She was so concerned that she was going to take a focus off of David being the lead singer, that if you look at videos or photos of her, there's a lot of times she's got her hair really short.
Right.
And it was more because she was trying to downplay as much as possible her stage presence because she really, and you know, and I guess the reason I bring that up is what a considerate person, to really kind of look at the band as a group, play a role where she, you know, wanted to just make sure the light really shined on David.
Especially in a sexist society when you got a bunch of knuckleheads out there in the audience and they want her to sex it up a little bit, you know, and wear something skimpy. I think that says a lot about her being a strong woman saying, you know what, I'm going to dress this way and it's all about the music and not about me trying to push my looks out there to, especially in an MTV era where video was king. I mean, the camera was right there in your face all the time.
You know, so I suppose that's really pretty spot on. But again, Chris and Tina were awesome. They ended up marrying, and they're just wonderful people. And Jerry Harrison, I ran into him at a South by Southwest probably about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was the best place for me was the Four Seasons because I just loved it. It was like the epicenter to schmooze.
Because it seemed like that's where everyone ended up at the end of the night.
Yeah.
It was all walks of life.
Yeah. And so I just kind of hung out there all the time. And Jerry comes up to me and goes, "You look really familiar." And I go, "Well, matter of fact." So we yucked it up, had a good time. He was a great guy, too.
You know, the thing I love about the Talking Heads also, you said when you added more musicians to it, especially from the percussion and the beat, if you will. I mean, that's the thing about the Talking Heads. They always really had a good groove to them, you know? I mean, it was rock. And it was new wave, but it wasn't too synthesized. I mean, it just had this nice percussion thing about Talking Heads. And even going up to David Byrne's solo career, he's always managed to kind of keep that good percussion thing going.
Yeah, I'd have to give an enormous amount of credit to Chris and Tina.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, look at the Tom Tom Club. I mean, that's what that was all about. Yeah. It's about grooving. It's a great dance song.
All right, we're following my tour. All of a sudden, I have Thin Lizzy August 30th in Kalamazoo. And we had just signed them, so they were kind of cleaning up on the album that they currently had out, and then we were releasing our own product.
They were cleaning up on aisle two way back then.
yeah. And then I had Foghat and Thin Lizzy together in Flint, Michigan on September 11th, and then I had Bonnie Raitt in Detroit. And Bonnie is really somebody we should talk about because talk about a guy's girl.
Right.
She was a guy's girl.
Yeah.
I mean, she could cuss like a sailor and she could drink bourbon and smoke cigarettes and do
she could play.
And she could play. And she was an incredible guitar player. And I don't know if there's a whole lot of people that can slide guitar the way she can.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and this was way before she really popped big, and unfortunately, it's kind of sad, but she ended up going to Capitol Records, and Tasha Mack helped break her into a big, big artist, because for some reason, we just didn't take her to the level that she ended up becoming, because now when you say Bonnie Raitt, most people know exactly who that is.
Legend.
But again, when you look at Little Feat, she was always with Lowell George, doing a lot of harmonies. Her and Emmylou Harris were huge Little Feet fans, and were always a guest on a lot of their records.
Right.
And she was part of that cohesive unit of music. And then, of course, now we've got this whole new group of people, thanks to Seymour, Stein, and Sire, and Island Records, bringing a different depth and dimension to the Warner Brother roster.
Right.
Thin Lizzy show in Detroit ends up being a somewhat iconic show, mostly because they had this band called AC/DC opening for them. And again, AC/DC hadn't really popped yet.
Right.
And Thin Lizzy, you know, the boys are back in town. How big is that song?
Huge. You know, to this day, still.
To this day. And I have to tell you, I like those guys a lot. Phil somehow really liked me, because you know when people really like you because they want to pal with you and hang out with you. And so him and I really, for whatever reason, hit it off to the point where it was me, him, and Scott Gorman.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because back then Gary Moore was with them, and Gary was just a quiet storm. I mean, he ended up being this amazing blues guitar player on his own. And again, I come full circle with Virgin Records and Point Blank Records, and we have Gary Moore.
Yeah.
So I had a chance to be with him later on before he passed away.
What was your favorite Thin Lizzy song at the time?
Well, you know, Boys Are Back in Town was, you know,
it's huge.
It was huge. But what I was going to say is Phil liked me so much that we ended a tour and we were done. We weren't going to be with each other anymore. And so he wanted to give me a parting gift. So he gave me this sweatshirt that he had that was a Thin Lizzy World Tour sweatshirt.
Wow.
It stank so bad.
I'm sure it did.
Oh, my gosh.
One that he had worn.
Yes.
Oh, I got you.
Oh,
okay.
My gosh. And so I had to, it's almost like I had to put it in a plastic bag in the trunk to get it home. You know, the gesture was extremely sweet, but the reality was, whoa.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So the reason why this was kind of a classic opportunity to be with them is the next day, Van Halen was, again, opening up for Black Sabbath. So this is the fourth time I had them in my market in 1 year. And
that's amazing.
And at this point, the reason why I say it's such a classic is because I have a photograph that a really good friend of mine, Ted Cohen, he was the A&R guy for Warner Brothers. And I ran into him one day at South by Southwest, and he goes, "Fred, I have this picture I got to get to you." And so he sends it to me, and it's this picture of Black Sabbath with Eddie, with Thin Lizzy.
Wow.
And they're all together in this one room, and then there's me, and I'm super young. And you can tell I'm super young. And that was the night that we took this photograph, because it was after the show, and we was able to corral everybody together. The only person from Van Halen in the shot was Eddie. But you've got Ozzy in there, and you've got Tony in there, and
wow,
you've got everybody kind of in that shot. So this is when Van Halen is certainly, they're hitting it on all cylinders. And Black Sabbath is struggling to keep up with Van Halen. And they're struggling with Ozzy as well.
Right.
So
even then, it was already a problem.
Oh, no. Not only was it a problem, but with Van Halen just really pushing the limits musically.
Right.
They were pretty much off the tour soon after this. And it had everything to do with them just really rising to the moment.
Right.
And also, you know, the internal problems that they were having with Ozzy. This was the time also when Van Halen had that big thing about the M&Ms.
Mm-hmm.
And the true story about the brown M&Ms was simply this. If the band had brown M&Ms mm-hmm. in their backstage room, they
right.
would proceed to destroy anything in sight.
Okay.
And in the contract they had written, they didn't have to, there was a lot of things that they got away with.
Right.
So, but the whole point of it, and I meant to quote David Lee Roth with this, because in his book, Crazy from the Heat, he explained it really well.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he explained it was simply this. They didn't always have a hall that was built to support the weight of the type of equipment that these guys started to bring on the road.
Okay.
So they started to bring an enormous amount of production to all these concert venues, whether they could handle it or not, which became a safety issue.
Right.
Because the light trusses are heavy and all of that. So they needed to make sure that there were specific things that would, from a safety standpoint, mm-hmm. take on the type of production that they're now used to on the road as they've morphed into a pretty big selling rock and roll band.
Right.
So they figured that somewhere in the middle of their rider, of all the things they need, not only you know, from what type of beverages and snacks they have backstage, it's more about what type of power surges and
right.
how large is the back door to get the equipment through the back door. And
sure.
they want to know all of this stuff.
Right.
So everything's kind of spelled out in this rider.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to bury in there that if there's any brown M&Ms in the candy bowl in the back stage dressing room, that they knew right then and there that these people didn't read the fine print.
Right.
And it was all about them reading the fine print for the safety factor.
That's amazing. That's a good story. I love that.
Yeah. So the other part of this is I had told you that the band had been to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they went to Japan, David ended up buying this huge bucket of rabbit's feet.
Okay.
And they were keychains. And so I remember at the Cobo Hall show, we, you know, the sound check's usually around 4:30. So I'm there. And for whatever reason, he had this innate ability to pull the most beautiful, you know, the girls next door, I guess
right.
is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not groupies that make a profession out of following the bands. These are legitimate girl next door beauties.
Right.
And he would have them all the time, you know, backstage. And he would be, you know, here's this really handsome guy with these patched rock and roll jeans. And he's got this mane of blonde hair. And he's heading up this amazing rock band. And he's telling this girl that she means so much to him that he wants her to have his special rabbit's foot.
Wow.
And she would be hanging on his every word. And she was just like taking it all in.
Yeah.
Because he wrapped it, her, you know, in such a bow where she was so special.
Yeah.
And he did that every single night and every
worked.
Single show.
And now you know what it means about getting lucky from owning a rabbit's foot.
Yeah, because he had a massive jar of And the other thing I'll leave you guys with is that same year, you know, the band loved to create chaos. It was kind of, you know, their deal. So they put out their own backstage passes, and they would have all their roadies and everybody distribute them everywhere.
Yeah.
And it just created havoc with the security guards.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because they couldn't decipher between this one or the legitimate ones. And that, I think, was the whole point of them doing that, because what had happened is the Van Halen World Tour all of a sudden became the Van Halen World Party.
Right.
Then that was their whole mode of apparatus.
Which sounds like a great way to go out and, you know, talk about someone who knew how to party and hang with them again. We dedicate this to our beloved friend Tasha Mack, and I'm sure you're kicking out a windshield in a rental car or sinking a jet ski somewhere in heaven tonight.
God bless you, Tasha Mack.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.